Hi there, and welcome back to the TV podcast. We are discussing chapter two of the HBO revival of Perry Mason. I'm your host, Evan Higgins, and joining me for this episode is a newcomer, as I know, to the TV podcast. His name is Kirk McPike. Kirk, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what your take on the series has been so far through these first two episodes. But before we dive into that, how about if you can, give me a little bit of background into your interest in the show. What brought you into Perry Mason? Are you familiar with the character? Kind of what is your interest in this?
So my dad was a lawyer, I guess still is a lawyer. And so Perry Mason was part of our life when we were kids. You know, I grew up seeing reruns of the 1950s TV show with him, the mid-80s TV movies. I don't know if you remember those, where Perry Mason continued to solve cases by getting the guilty person up on the stand to convince them to confess, but didn't really move around as much because Raymond Burr was getting very old at that point. And he had a succession of different, relatively attractive private investigators working with him in Della Street as they were solving cases. So yeah, I kind of came in, I think like a lot of viewers would, with sort of the mental image of Perry Mason in my mind is that, you know, black suited, square jawed Raymond Burr from the 1950s series. So this has been an interesting adjustment to this new show and the very different take on the character. And, you know, I guess in some ways I sort of just am thinking about this as a really well done 1930s noir story, and trying to kind of keep everything that I know of Perry Mason from those old shows out of my head.
Indeed. And what was your reaction to the first episode last week?
Actually, I was a little shaky after the first episode. I wasn't sure exactly where this was going and if I was really going to enjoy it. Obviously they wanted to start off with a bang, and the baby on the ascending car, rail car, was pretty gruesome and grim. But I felt like this episode, they really found their footing. The second episode, and they figured out where they're going with it, and I was really enjoying it a lot more this time. So I'm very excited with this episode and to see where it goes going forward.
Well, with that said, why don't we dive right into it? We'll give you the rundown for episode two. Again, it's an 8-episode miniseries, and every episode is marked by chapters. So yes, Last week was chapter one, this is chapter two.
So, yeah, they didn't spend a lot of time worrying about episode titles.
No, when you only have 8 episodes to be able to plan out a series, that's one of those I think gets kicked by the wayside. And it's like, if we don't have to worry about it, we won't. Yep. We have much more important things to deal with as far as getting this story told in the time frame they gave themselves. So the synopsis for chapter two is as follows. We pick up at the end of chapter one with the two detectives that we met, Holcomb and Ennis, along with the LA District Attorney, Maynard Barnes, who we will definitely touch on later. They accost the father of the baby that we discover in chapter one has died, Charlie Dodson. They arrest his father, Matthew, after evidence planted by Ennis and the revelation that the elder from the church that hired Mason and the attorney, E.B. Jonathan, is actually the father of Matthew Dodson. They place Matthew under arrest. Now Mason and Bagley have to go through trying to figure out whether or not he actually did it or not. And in the process, we find out more about Perry's backstory, especially when it's intercut with scenes of him during World War I. At that point, the story shifts to Officer Paul Drake, who we're seeing for the first time. He finds in an apartment in a slightly dilapidated part of LA, bodies of two of the kidnappers who we saw in chapter one, and then goes up and tries to find out what happened to the third one, who we are still trying to find out about. Meanwhile, Perry is getting an eye that Charlie's mother, Emily, may have a role, a bigger role in what happened with her son's death. And that ties her to a man named George Gannon, whom his body is found in a rundown house, along with letters proving that they had an affair, George and Emily did. So you fast forward to Charlie's funeral, and following a rather improvised sermon by Sister Alice, who we are finally introduced to in full in this episode, Emily is arrested, and now we are left trying to figure out exactly who was involved with what, to what degree, and just how big of a knot is Perry going to have to untie. From there, we'll go into what we liked and didn't like about this one. And Kirk, I'll let you go. What did you like about this episode?
Paul Drake is a great character. The African-American police officer who basically figures the whole thing out because he's sort of taken to the scene by the people of the city who he, you know, is a street cop. Paul Drake, for people who watched the original show, was the name of the private investigator who worked for Perry on the 1950s show. So it's kind of, we're seeing a dual origin story here, which I really appreciate, sort of building out other people from the original series universe to kind of give us an introduction to them. I thought that his performance, the actor's performance, I think it was Chris Chalk, he was very solid in the role, particularly the scene where the two detectives were condescendingly sort of trying to poke holes in his very solid police work to try to not give him too much credit for it. Like, I really liked him. I'm looking forward to seeing how they take that character forward. And the other character who was introduced this week, who I think is just great, is the DA, who's played by Stephen Root, who is one of my favorite actors of all time.
Loved it.
He was just born to play this role. Like I said, it has that perfect mix of smarmy and smart. What he that's his sweet spot right there. Like the way he stages the photo op at the very beginning as he's leading the father out of the interrogation, all the way to the end when he's toasting them with the whiskey at the club after arresting yet another member of this family for the death of their son.
I'll start with Paul Drake, because it's also worth noting in the 1950s version that Paul Drake, which should not be a big surprise, was a Caucasian actor playing him, William Hopper. And in this one, Chris Chalk, who you mentioned, I remember seeing him in Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom. He was one of the reporters in The Newsroom, and he was somewhat of a, he wasn't necessarily a jerk, but he was a no-nonsense, no-frills sort of guy. You asked him a question, you got a blunt answer sometimes. But to see him branch out and be Paul Drake in this, I thought was a smart casting move. In doing some research on this, the character originally created by Earl Stanley Garner in the books was never really fleshed out. So there was a lot of ambiguity there for the writers of this version of Perry Mason to take it in this direction without really going against what the original intent for the character was.
No, I think they handled that very, very well.
That said, he may very well be my favorite character in this series before the show is out. You know, it's one of those where you know within a minute when you're looking at somebody in a show and you just go, okay, there's something about him that just resonates with me. And it was seeing a competent person doing their job. And like you said, we were first introduced to Drake as he's breaking up a domestic dispute between an African-American couple, an older African-American couple, where the guy is refusing to vacate their apartment and he's got a rifle.
Yeah, threatening.
And Drake has to be the voice of reason. And he also has to contend with the fact that the people he is there to help don't want him there. And that the older gentleman accosts him and basically says, look, just because you're wearing that uniform, you've got that badge, doesn't make you police. And even if you are police, all you are is a guy on a leash for the people that you serve. It's interesting to see how we've got a character here in Drake who is maligned to an extent by his own people because he chose to be a police officer. And then,
but not fully accepted by the police either.
No. And as you pointed out, when he is, after he has a chance to investigate the scene where he finds the dead bodies and then tracks where Gannon went to the top of the building, there's no subtlety there in how condescending their bigotry is towards him of pointing out, saying, hey, you know, you're really smart. It's just too bad there aren't any black guys who are police officers. And they're not even that politically correct in how they explain it. You know, again,
not even for 1931.
No. And again, this is 1931 LA. It is a much different world in some ways than what we are in now. But in a lot of ways, whereas we're finding out more and more as current affairs pan out, it still very much mirrors that time. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Drake continues to evolve as a character, especially because, and I'm not giving away anything here, but if you watch chapter two and you saw the preview for chapter three, he's going to run into Perry, and that is going to be the starting point for whatever their relationship is ultimately going to be.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that. I don't know about you.
I'm very much looking forward to, like, the whole character of Drake is just, he's competence personified, right? Like, dealing with that domestic dispute with the couple who, as you said, don't want them there. Like, I couldn't tell if he was lying to give the wife a cover story to defuse the situation or not, but either way, he did it perfectly and addressed a just a very violent situation without anyone coming to harm. And no, he's, the performance is great. The character is fantastic. And yeah, it's like they really nailed it. They've done such a good job casting this show, with one exception. It's not a bad casting. It's just that the gentleman who played Greg and the gentleman who plays the father of the child look too much alike, which caused confusion for me in the last episode. I actually thought that Matthew, the dad of Charlie, had been killed at the end of the last episode. And then he shows up in the church in the first scene, which was a bit disorienting for me. But
yeah, and we'll get to that in a second. But I want to, because you put a pin in it.
Yeah.
Stephen Root as Maynard Barnes, the DA. It was one of those instances where as soon as he walked in the room, and I don't get this very often, and you especially don't expect to get this in this sort of gritty noir type story, but my heart leapt, because I have seen Stephen Root going from Office Space through Oh Brother Where Art Thou, through all these great character roles that he has excelled in over his career. And you're right, Kirk, he assumes that role of the DA, of a 1930s DA, who knows how to manipulate the press, who knows how to manipulate the situation and utilize the authority that the police have to his advantage to be able to make these big leaps that leaves E.B. Jonathan both scratching his head and then completely dumbfounded when we get the revelation that Matthew Dodson, not only does he look like the guy that we saw at the end of episode one, but he's not even Matthew Dodson.
No, Matthew Baggerly.
Yeah, we find out that he is actually the son of Herman Baggerly, who was the elder from the church who hired Jonathan and Perry to find out what happened to Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
Which then now explains how he got the money, because that was something we were left scratching our heads at the end of chapter one. Okay, if he's a guy who runs an ordinary grocery store, how does he get $100,000? Well, if you have a rich dad who can get you that sort of cash in a hurry, there you go. I agree with you that how they've picked the casting by going with character actors. Yes, Matthew Reese is the figurehead for this, and you have somebody like John Lithgow who has that gravitas given the length of his career, and Tatiana Maslany, who I know we'll get to before we're done here, as a counterpoint to Reese's Perry. But they have stocked this with really, really solid character actors who can take this story and move it in the directions that they want it to go in, but also not leave you sitting there going, oh, I need to make sure that we get this person in it because they're a big name actor.
No, I say what I love is, like, particularly Root and Lithgow are so great sparring with each other. Like, the chemistry there is so strong. And I think it's probably because they're both actually comedic actors at heart. And there is a sort of gentlemanly smirk to their conflict, right? In their the barbs they throw at one another. There's a level of respect, but also disdain. Like, they sell it just so perfectly. Just a few couple interactions, and you see this entire relationship that has obviously been going on for years between these two lawyers in just perfect detail. It's excellent casting, excellent writing, and excellent performances. So, yeah.
And like, before I ended up becoming a journalist, which I've done for the last 10 years, I spent a decade working for a sole proprietor attorney. So, and that is as far of a connection to saying that I understand Perry Mason as I will go, because all I was a legal assistant. I was much more Della Street than I was.
I love you, Della Street. Outfit.
Although I will freely admit she looks far, far better in a dress, and I'm not nearly as nice answering phones. But that adversarial relationship that is like, it's like tennis, where you have that back and forth and somebody's going to get a point, your opponent's going to get a point, but it's all about what you can do in those last kind of, when you rush the net. And how, you know, we see Jonathan telling Perry that, well, you know, Maynard has overplayed himself and he's going to get him. Mm-hmm. But when Maynard is able to turn it around on Jonathan and we see him just at a loss. Yeah, it is. I'm looking forward to how that dynamic also develops. And yeah. And again, we've only got 6 episodes left, so they're not going to be able to spend a whole lot of time on it. But the economy by which we've gotten it, even in this second hour, I thought was great.
Yeah, there's not a lot of padding in this show, right? Like sometimes even in these newer, shorter TV seasons that are 12 to 13 episodes long, there'll be some filler in every episode and maybe even like entirely filler episodes in the middle of the season. I think that we're with 8 episodes, we're skipping all that. Like this, every single scene, there's an economy to it and it all matters in terms of the end result of the story.
So, right. But again, to your point about the about the way it was cast, again, it was something we touched on in episode 1 about how Matthew Rhys wasn't originally supposed to be Perry Mason. It was supposed to be Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, he was a little too old, I think, for this part at this point. And as you said, a little too Disney at this point.
And also, I think having a big name like that, I think it would have overshadowed everybody else. One area that they do spend a lot of time on in Chapter 2 is about Perry's involvement in the war. And yeah, it starts right from the word go, because we catch him in the middle of a battle in Europe in World War I. And he has to go over the top with a bunch of his comrades. And all he has is a Colt 1911 pistol. And and I don't know about you, Kirk, but I'm a big history nut of all sorts. And I've listened to a lot of material on World War I as with World War II. And just the level of, I'm not sure if there's really an apt, if it's bravery, insanity, whatever, but to blow that whistle and go over the top of that trench, knowing what is waiting for you on the other side.
You have to be a little bit crazy and unbelievably brave to do that. I don't know if I could do that. I went through a phase, I think a lot of folks do, where I got very interested in World War I, and some of my friends did. We were reading books and listening to Dan Carlin's podcast about it and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, you noted the exact same things I noted. Like he's afraid, but he does the up and over, and he's running out there with a pistol. He's in World War I, and he doesn't even have like a real rifle. I can't imagine. No bayonet, no way to defend himself if it gets into a close quarters fight, which we see later on. They did a great job sort of capturing the chaos and horror of trench warfare in just a very few minutes of this episode.
Yeah, and if I may don my Carlin cap for a minute, because part of what I was interested in was when Jonathan is explaining to Baggerly in episode 1 about how Perry is a veteran of the Battle of the Argonne, and how in chapter 2, they talk about how in a heated conversation between Baggerly and Perry over Matthew's connection to him, and how at first he was saying he was just a parishioner in his church, now he's his son, and now he's all stepping up saying he's got to be able to defend him. Perry goes right through that and starts really jabbing Baggerly on it, and Baggerly comes back by explaining how Perry's war record is not as clean as people like to say it is, because he was a veteran of the Battle of the Argonne, but also they called him the Butcher of Montfaucon. Now, from a historical perspective, again, this is set in 1931 LA. The Battle of the Meuse-Argonne Forest started September of 1918 and ran all the way to Armistice Day on November 11th. It was the largest offensive in U.S. military history. There were 1.2 million soldiers there. So we just see a pocket of that with Perry. It was also the second deadliest battle in U.S. history. There were 26,000 casualties American, of almost 350,000 total casualties American, German, French. The Argonne is in the northeast of France near the border, and historically, the site of the American memorial to that battle is at Montfaucon. Huh. So the writers did their homework in trying to put this together.
They grounded it in real things.
It does not sound like it was something that they just went, oh, well, we'll just slap this in and make it sound good. They actually did a little bit of research and threw that in there, which I don't know if we're going to see more of that or not. But when you understand that sort of historical context, seeing those moments where Perry has, let's make no bones about it, he's dealing with extreme PTSD.
Yeah.
Based on that experience, you don't go through that and not come out the other side with resounding psychic scars from it.
No, I think that we will see more of this, not maybe not this specific battle, but we're going to see more about this in World One, because we don't right yet have the answer of why he got the blue card discharge, right? The blue ticket discharge. We see hints at it here, I think, when he first goes up and over and he's fighting with the pistol and he ends up in a German trench. And there's an American soldier who's grievously wounded who begs him to kill him, to mercy kill him. And then later at the end of the episode, we see him actually doing that. And I'm wondering if that's the butchery that, gets referred to by Baggerly. But I think that there's more trauma here in World War One that we're going to learn about from Perry Mason, that is about Perry Mason, that it's why his marriage failed. It's going to be why he can't let go of that dairy farm. It's obviously the core of what broke him as a person. And if this episode is, or this show is supposed to be a prequel, at least part of that is probably going to be, you know, at least pointing himself towards stitching himself back together after it.
And it's worth noting that what we get at the end of it, where we see him starting to take out his own troops, which is a crucial area in this, is that the one thing he sees before the end, and even calls it out to the other troops, is he sees gas.
Yeah.
And by that, the Germans have let go of a noxious weapon. Could be mustard gas, could be something, but whatever it is, it's coming. And
it's going to be worse than the bullet. And that's why he's doing what he's doing.
And when he looks down and sees wounded guys who can't get away from it, he is put in a very, very difficult spot, which you put any person who's been in any theater of war at any time in it and give him that choice, would they act the same way? I don't know. I certainly can't say that, and I've never even served. So,
yeah, I have no idea.
But the blue ticket was something that came up in World War One and World War Two.
Yep.
And it was a way to for the upper ranks to filter out who they refer to as undesirables. And it was, based on the research I did, it was applied primarily to soldiers who were confirmed homosexual and also African-Americans. But with African-Americans, it was utilized regardless of what their sexual preference was. So while it looks like the ticket has to do with in what he did with the troops, there is a line where when Haggerly is jabbing Mason on it, it starts with a little bit of levity. And I wonder if Matthew Rhys threw this in because he is actually English, where he says to Haggerly, "I'm actually a quarter Welsh."
Yeah.
"And I've only been queer once." And you see Jonathan's reaction to it, and you see Haggerly's reaction to it, and that's the end of the conversation.
Which is just more evidence. We're going to get more about this before we're done with this series. Because you're right, like the blue ticket existed, I think, until the 1950s is when they finally got rid of it as just sort of a quick dismissal tool and adopted the current structure for leaving the armed services, the honorable, dishonorable, and sort of middle ground discharges that exist today. Blue tickets and things like that were definitely used to target homosexual members of the military for decades. I don't think that's where they're going with Perry, but obviously it is something that you could use against a soldier if you wanted to hang that around them, right? If you wanted to discredit them in the broader society when they left the service because of what they did, well, it's kind of like pinning a scarlet letter to them.
Well, and let me ask you this, because again, a lot of what we know about Perry Mason is obviously tied to the Raymond Burr 1950s, 1960s version of it.
Yeah.
In that time, something like this would not even be remotely brought up, especially for the leading character, which...
Yes, as a gay man, we do claim Raymond Burr as one of our own.
From that perspective, do you think that the time is right now, if the writers want to go in that direction...
I do wonder, though, if it might be received like making Sulu gay in the new Star Trek movies where everybody just thinks he did it. Well, they did do it just because George Takei is himself gay. I don't know. I think that we got pretty ample evidence, or at least some evidence, in the first episode that Perry Mason is not gay. I don't know. I'm not sure where they're going with this, but I don't get the impression that's it. I think that butcher nickname is going to be the hook for all of this mystery regarding his World War One service.
Mm-hmm. And it might be a case where And the only sort of app comparison that comes to mind is kind of a Kaiser Soze sort of thing, where you think one thing about this character and it goes in a different way. And we don't know, like you said, which way that pendulum is going to swing.
Yep.
But even so, that you have the opportunity to create misdirection and also character development in the same situations.
You're building little mystery boxes into the story. And since it's not J.J. Abrams, I assume that when we get to the end, they'll actually open them and we'll see what's in them. I look forward to that.
So what else about this episode did you like that sprang to mind? I know one of the things you pointed out was how visually the show is being
represented. This show makes grime beautiful. Like, it is so well shot. I love the opening credits, not even opening credits, just the opening title card with the Perry Mason that they do with the thin 1930s film style typography. And this is obviously they can't shoot in LA as it was back then, but they have lovingly and meticulously recreated it. You can tell in every shot sort of the socioeconomic class of the home that you're in, the characters, the detail on the clothing. It's just, it is such a lovingly and carefully made production that it shines through in every single frame of this. And I think it's gorgeous to look at.
I can't help but wonder if the writers for this show also happen to be Mr. Robot fans.
I never saw that show, but everybody says they should. So,
well, the reason why I bring it up is that Sam Esmail, part of his brilliance in doing that show, was he found new and interesting ways to incorporate the title card.
Okay.
And as soon as I saw that Perry Mason card, I went, I bet they pinch that in some way from Sam Esmail, which, yeah, imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. I don't think he'll be offended. But yeah, I did like the ingenuity of that, to have that again in that old classic 1930s script, as you said. It was different.
With the Roman numeral date at the bottom, you have the MMXIX there. And it's so well done.
Mm-hmm. So another development that I did like in this is the continuing relationship between Mason, Della, and E.B. Jonathan.
Yeah.
You know, we see all three of them working to do their job. We see Mason as the investigator. We see Della as the assistant. And Jonathan, obviously, is the attorney. And all three of them not necessarily having the best time doing it. You know?
No. But a very interesting dynamic, right? Like, Della is very much like she was in the 1950s show. She's someone whose opinion is heard and respected, even if it's not necessarily listened to. And I appreciate the tension between her and Perry as they're sort of vying for Evie's sort of agreement with their take on the case. She makes the two men sharper.
Yes. Well, and as my compadre pointed out in chapter one, she's the adult in the room. She's capable of being the one who can reel in both Perry and Jonathan when they are at their bantering best and get them in line, even though and that moment where she keeps having to go out and answer the phone and Jonathan is like, you know, it's E.B. Jonathan and Associates. And she's like, it hasn't been that way since, what, like the mid-20s. And then she just to stick it to him, E.B. Jonathan and Associates. And you see him like, damn it. You know, it. And the scene in the diner where Della has taken the role of Emily's chaperone due to the press heat that she is getting as a result of her husband being arrested at the time. And again, we see a lot more detective work, which I don't want to overstate it because it almost sounds like it's supposed to be a given. But in shows like this, we don't see this sort of detective work that Perry is undertaking that much.
No, you're right. Like, it's not one of these situations where everything falls into place for him very easily. It's, you know, he has to sneak around, even around his own folks, right? He has to sneak around Della and then swoop into that phone booth and call in a favor from a friend to track down the phone number. He's putting in the footwork, very much like the Drake character does in the 1950s series. It's not like the most complicated mystery that he's trying to resolve. Like, it's not like he faces a ton of obstacles as he's like unraveling the identity of her paramour, but we see him work, we see how he approaches it, and we see how he utilizes the resources and friends and connections he's made during the time that he's been doing this private investigator work to unravel it. And it's fun.
That Della understands Perry enough to realize that she's being tailed.
Yeah, she's right there on top of
him. In the booth. Yeah, she throws the door, but you're really crappy at tailing people. And he's like, what do you want? I'm getting the job done, you know?
Inconspicuous when you're always the worst dressed person in every room you enter.
Well, when your clothier is the mortician, I mean, your options you don't have a lot are very choices. Much limited. So what did you think about when he goes out and finds George Gannon? To me, it was both dark and unlike the provocative stuff we got in chapter one of obviously a more titillating nature. This was the antithesis of it, but still got your attention.
It was gruesome in a unique way that wasn't nearly as disturbing as the baby at the start of the first episode. But again, like the makeup or composite or just dummy work, whatever they did for the body was incredibly well done. Also, like, I enjoyed seeing Perry not just find the body, but like inspect the space and put it all together. You know, he sees the doll of the alligator, and on the bottom it's listed as the same, is it amusement park or something?
That I believe that
the turtle toy was from, that he'd seen in Charlie's bedroom at the Dodson's house. And even before he pulls those letters out, I think he's starting to put together what the connection here might have been, given that she had been calling him and calling him and calling him. His choice to confront her was an interesting one, as opposed to going to his employer about it first. I'm not sure what drove him to take that approach, but it was definitely a strong scene for both of those actors.
It was. And the moment where he tells her that George is dead, this man she's been having an affair with, how to that point she has tried to be so stone-faced, both with her own husband and with the death of her son. And then as soon as she finds out that her lover is dead,
just breaks her.
Yeah, she literally hits the floor. And
of course, you have to wonder, what's the paternity of the child if she has this lover who was somehow involved in this kidnapping to extort money from her husband's father, and the husband and the person she's having the affair with look enough alike that we got them confused last episode. I wonder if that's something that's going to unravel over the course of the next few episodes as well.
And I do owe at this point a mea culpa as far as the conclusion I drew at the end of chapter one. And going back and looking at it, I don't think it was just me that got caught off guard by it, or at least I hope not. We said at the end of chapter one that it looked like Charlie's father, Matthew Dodson, was involved in the kidnapping and died at the end of episode one. It turns out that no, it was George Gannon, who was the third man in the apartment when the detective Innes shows up with that suitcase and kills the other two. He wounds George, and that's how he gets to the roof and dies.
Right, falls off and dies. I completely thought that was Matthew. I did not know. I was right there with you, even though I wasn't on the podcast last week. That was my takeaway from watching the episode as well. And whether that's intentional or not on their part, or just that in a gray suit and a 1930s fedora in a dark room, everyone of that build looks basically the same. I don't know.
And because of that, they're able to use that, the detectives are, against Matthew Dobson here in chapter two.
Right.
They bring him down for questioning. He comes in with the suitcase that he had brought in when he killed the three guys. And then obviously, since he was right there, he can grab the suitcase, bring it in, use it against Dobson as the evidence they need to be able to arrest him.
Yeah.
On top of that, you have Maynard Haynes, the DA, saying somebody who bears a very
striking
close
resemblance
to Matthew Dobson was seen taking the baby out of the house. Well,
it all is well done and intentional. Yeah. You're right.
When you pair George Gannon with Matthew Dobson, if we were left scratching our heads at the end of chapter one going, wait a minute, was that that was the dad, wasn't it? We're going to be just as flummoxed as Jonathan is.
So what you're saying is that Emily has a type.
It definitely appears that way. We find out just how much it's going to end up costing her. But before we get to that, I'd be very remiss if we did not touch on Sister Alice, because we knew from the previews that Tatiana Maslany was going to be a part of this as Sister Alice. And she is the voice for this Pentecostal style church that exists in this story.
Yeah, this church is very interesting. I have a lot of questions about it.
Yeah, I do too. My thought on it was, and also this plays into, again, the time frame of you have the early Depression Los Angeles at a time where you had a lot of people asking a lot of questions and you had a lot of God-fearing people looking to whatever avenues they could for any self-assurance that things were going to be okay. Because they weren't getting it from the government. They weren't getting it from a lot of things that they originally were leaning on. And again, throughout this chapter, we see instances of things like Hoovervilles. We see the slums. We see the ghettos. We see how run down certain parts of L.A. are. As opposed
that long series of shots at the end with Perry and Drake sort of walking through the human misery of the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you juxtapose that against the posh club where Haynes and Jonathan are, and you realize where the lines of demarcation have been drawn. And in between that, you have this church that is stepping in and trying to be not only a form of spiritual counsel for these people, but also seeing an opportunity to help themselves around this figurehead of Sister Alice. And man, I'm really liking her.
She's great. The actress is great. The performance is just mesmerizing. But I keep getting pulled out of it because churches like that typically don't have women in major preaching roles, particularly 80 years ago, 90 years ago. That would be very rare.
That's a good point.
Also, the way and it seems like a very conservative group of men, not like politically, but just like reserved group of men who run the church as the elders. So I'm wondering, what's her story? Obviously there is a narrative that this church has around her, why she's the one who delivers these messages to the rapturous crowd. And I'm assuming that we will learn that over the course of the next few episodes. Maybe also why this church calls itself a temple and how it became so politically connected throughout the city that, they have these Hollywood stars and the mayor coming in even for the funeral for this young boy. It's a very interesting sort of X factor in this story. Clearly it plays into whatever conspiracy is afoot here, just exactly how and who knows about it, whether Sister Alice or the rather controlling figure of her mother or just the elders. I don't know. It's intriguing. I was also struck by the use of the neon light and the cross in the church, and thinking about how that would be very new technology at the time. And I wonder if churches really did adopt things like that, like bright, just piercing neon lights, to show sort of brilliance and divinity. And I don't know enough about Pentecostal or, that sort of church design from 100 years ago to know if that's something that they're playing on that was real or not, but it surely is striking.
It does leave a lot of questions that, as you point out, need to be touched on more over the next six chapters. My theory on it is this. Sister Alice as a figurehead, and also an interesting aspect of it, is that when we first see her, she's giving her sermon, and somebody is following her around with a microphone because it's being sent out over radio.
Yeah, and broadcast to the crowd outside that can't get into the space.
Right. So very they're taking advantage of that technology, which was still, I don't want to say brand new, but it was still in its infancy at that time. But again, that was the biggest mass media driver of the day because you didn't have TV. You absolutely did not have the internet. So being able to get a voice out on the radio, and I think maybe to an extent because of that and her dynamicism as an orator and her ability to rile emotions and get people really into the message that, again, these elders are trying to convey, might have given them the ability to have somebody like her be that voice. Because as you say, and rightly so, that is very much against type, especially given that point in history.
Yeah. And, this is set, obviously, during the depths of the Depression. And we see, as she's giving her sort of impassioned sermon that first time, people who we don't know what sort of means they have, but probably not the sort of means they had 3 years earlier before the crash, opening up their wallets and filling those plates. that are being passed through the crowd. Like, this is obviously, she is an attraction that is drawing in attention and political clout and money to this church. And she has power, which she chooses to use in what appears to be defiance of her mother at the end of the episode. But also there is a leash there. And we see it in how the elders and her mother try to control what she's going to say and do.
So I'm glad you touched on that, because that was something that stuck out to me at the end as well, is that when she gives the funeral eulogy, and it is fire and brimstone. There's no easier way to put it. But then she goes and sits down, and her mother looks at her and says, "What was that?" Where you see the elders have, they're seeing her one way. It very much what I believe is that general patriarchal hierarchy of that sort of organization, where the elders will control everything, but they need a figurehead who will bring people in and put them in the seats and give of themselves, especially at a time when they don't have those sort of means readily available, as you've said. But you also see Sister Alice straining against that leash.
Yeah.
Looking to see just how much power she can wield, not just from the same position that the elders have, but just from herself as a female figurehead of this church, as the voice of it. How much can she bellow out to the masses?
Well, I feel like she's starting to see, and maybe she has before, and we're just now entering her story at this point, but that she realizes in a way that the elders don't, that the person with the microphone is the person with the power. And that's who the public is looking to and seeing as the church, no matter what the people in the background may be thinking. And I look forward to her and Mason sometime, like the sort of verbal wrestling he did with Bagley. I look forward to that between the two of them in future episodes.
Well, and they dangle that carrot in front of us, because at the end of that funeral, we have that moment where Sister Alice sees Perry, and Perry sees her, and they lock gaze from across the room. And you know that moment is coming. It's Chekhov's standoff right there. you can't have it without giving us that later on. But, of course, this episode ends with Emily Dodson getting arrested, walking out of the funeral. The cops just walk up and do it and make a huge scene in front of the church.
Drag her away screaming. And that actress, I hope she gets paid per scream. Like, she's doing a great job, but that is a rough emotional roller coaster of a role.
It is. And you have that moment as well where Della looks at Perry and Perry looks at Jonathan, and they all know why this is happening. Yeah. That Perry called it in because he reached the decision it was the right play. And Jonathan even says to him it was the right play.
Yeah. Della doesn't seem to agree.
Oh, God, no. And I know there's going to be a reckoning there, I suspect. If not in Chapter 3, then sometime immediately thereafter, where his methodology in that is definitely brought into question by her, because she's there in the jail bringing Emily clothes so she can get out of her widow's garb, while Perry is off doing what Perry does. Where I was kind of scratching my head about where things were going to go at the end of Chapter 1, this really assuaged a lot of my fears in Chapter 2. Because again, as we said both last week and this week, it's 8 episodes. They don't have the luxury of wasting time. If they waste time on it, they're going to lose the story or they're going to lose the audience.
Yep.
And we got so much character development. We got so much plot advancement in this chapter that if this is still the roller coaster going up to the drop, when is the drop going to hit? And boy, what a drop is that going to be? So for you, I'll give you the last word on it. What sort of stuff would you like to see over the last 6 chapters of this? And what do you think is going to happen?
So I have questions. First, I hope we keep getting to see Pete, because I think that he's a great character. And he had a little bit part in this episode. And I like sort of seeing Perry interacting with a peer who he seems to respect as kind of a friend. But on sort of the bigger picture, is Evie now Emily's attorney, and is Mr. Baggerly going to continue to pay for the defense of a woman who cheated on her husband, and through that cheating may have caused his grandson potentially to be killed. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out. And I wonder if perhaps EB takes this case pro bono, which sort of would explain his apparently fallen stature within the legal community in Los Angeles, if he's sort of so soft-hearted that he's taking cases that can't even pay the rent, and thus why there is no more associates at his firm. Also, something that was in the first episode, and I don't know if you saw it, it jumped out to me in one scene where Perry was looking at himself in the mirror. There was a diploma on the wall that looked like it was a university diploma. So I'm wondering, what is Perry's like education attainment level now? And are we going to see him start to move towards being less of a PI and more of a lawyer as this story progresses? HBO is doing this as a miniseries, so we can't presume that there will be a season two. So wherever they get him to in episode 8 is as far as they know they're ever going to get him to. So that sort of, I think, hangs over the air. Or hangs in the air, I should say, over the proceedings. And also, you know, when's he going to get somebody on the stand and badger them into confessing to the crime, which is the typical way that Perry Mason stories end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing about Pete that we didn't touch on was I do like how we have that moment where Perry is trying to make amends for what happened in episode 1 where they got snuck by the movie mogul. Was supposed to be $600 ended up being just a buck. But
$600 is a lot of money back then.
Oh, right? Yeah. Especially in the Depression era 30s. That's
huge. The $23 that he gives him in this episode is $450 in today's money.
But how we get that moment of understanding that Pete is Perry's mentor as an investigator.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have that and the potential flip side of E.B. Jonathan being his mentor as an attorney.
Pete teaches him how to do investigations. E.B. teaches him how to be a lawyer. Della teaches him how to be a human being.
But it could be. I don't know. Well, we have 6 more chapters to find out, and I'm looking forward to it, and I have a feeling that you are too. So
absolutely.
With that, we are going to close the book on Chapter 2 of Perry Mason. Again, thank you very much for listening to this podcast. You also check out other shows here on the Incomparable Network. Kirk, it was good to talk to you about it. I'm glad to be able to spend an hour with you.
I appreciate you having me on. This is a lot of fun. Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing the rest of the show and listening to the podcast.
So I will be back next week with Chapter 3. Until then, I've been Devin Higgins. It's been a lot of fun. I will talk to you then. Bye. Ah.